Welcome to the Veritas Forum.
This is the Veritas Forum podcast.
A place where ideas and beliefs converge.
What I'm really going to be watching is which one has the resources in their worldview to be tolerant, respectful, and humble toward the people they disagree with.
How do we know whether the lives that we're living are meaningful?
If energy, light, gravity, and consciousness are a mystery, don't be surprised if you're going to get an element of this in God.
Today we hear from Professor of Sociology and the Director of the Religion and Public Life Program at Rice University, Elaine Eklund, as she discusses why science and faith need each other, eight shared values that move us beyond fear, from the Veritas Forum at Arizona State University.
I am a professor of sociology at Rice University, where I also direct the Religion and Public Life Program. And for the past 15 years, I've been studying what scientists think about religion and what religious people think about science. As part of that work, I've surveyed nearly 26,000 scientists and done nearly 1,000 in-depth interviews with them in their labs and their offices. And I've also surveyed more than 30,000 members of the American public, including people who consider themselves Christians, people who consider themselves Muslims, those from many other traditions, as well as those who have no religion at all. And I want to give a big shout out to the gifted team that I work with and lead at Rice University through the Religion and Public Life Program. But unlike our other work, which is really geared towards academic audiences and broader publics, I wrote Why Science and Faith Need Each Other specifically for the Christian community, a community that I am a part of. Here is the first key insight of my work that I want to tell you about science and faith. It's this: when it comes to science and faith, there is a fine line between fear and anger. Here's my own story of fear. When my daughter was about 3 years old, I was picking her up from daycare. That day I was tired and I was parenting solo. I know some of these on this call identify. She begged to stay a few minutes to play with her friends and I acquiesced. They started a game of hide and seek, which kids often do at that age. And I turned away just for a minute to talk with another parent. The daylight was starting to fade. It was towards the end of the day. And I expected, of course, that at any minute she would kind of sidle up to me and wrap her arms around my leg. But after a few minutes, when that did happen, I started to look around. It's time to go, I called out. There wasn't any response. One by one, the parents and children, they got into their cars and they drove away and I called out again. I really mean it, it's time to go. Still nothing. I picked up my bag and I walked over to where she and her friends had been playing, but I didn't see anyone. Where are you? My heart started to race and I started to get that very physical manifestation of panic that we get. I checked up and down the street. I actually opened the doors of parked cars to look inside them because I thought maybe she'd crawled into one. Actually, a guy came out of his apartment and said, ma'am, are you trying to break into my car? And I didn't answer him. I had a singular mission. I actually had tears streaming down my face at that point. And I commissioned this stranger in the search. It had been about 10 minutes. And by then, several parents, the director of the daycare center were also searching. The director actually pulled me aside at that moment and said she had activated the safety protocol for a missing child. And in that moment, I truly believed I might not find my daughter. And I'm gonna tell you that I felt fear like I have never felt fear before. And then I felt a familiar touch on my leg. Mommy, have I been bad? Will I have my TV taken away tonight? I grabbed my daughter up and I hugged her so tight that she actually asked me to loosen my grip. And even now, many years later, as I'm telling you this story, my skin is sort of like tingling right now, actually. And I felt this kind of intense relief like I haven't felt before. Then at that point, I noticed a little boy standing beside her. He told us he had actually heard her breathing and her giggle as he came near. And well, I mean, I think you're getting where I'm going with this. The bottom line is this, that the entire time I was searching, she had actually been hiding within 10 feet of me. She had heard me. She'd heard the associate director. She'd heard the parent who was helping me search and the other people who are in the search, all of us calling, and yet she'd chosen not to answer. I let her down on the sidewalk, and then, and I'm sure now that I have your attention, that I grabbed her arm and I looked into her face and I yelled, "I am so angry. I want to give you such a spanking." She starts sobbing and the boy starts sobbing too. The director of the daycare, the one who had called the safety protocol, she actually touched my arm at that point. And I guess she didn't want to witness what was going to happen next, but she said, "Let's take a step back. There is a fine line between fear and anger. There's a fine line between fear and anger." Over the years, I have brought this lesson to my academic work on how religious people view science, and particularly how Christians, a community that I'm very concerned about and am part of, how Christians view science and scientists, and how scientists view religion and religious people. Fear can often masquerade as anger leading to conflict. And when we see conflict between faith and science, we need to get curious. We need to examine whether there might be underlying fear, and we need to try to understand that fear. And so take a pause just a minute with me and ask yourself, and get that piece of paper that I asked you to get out. Ask yourself, when it comes to connecting science and faith, science and religion, what are you afraid of? What are you afraid of? And now write down your answer. A little interlude. Here's what I, as a sociologist, bring to the table of discussion on science and faith. Sociologists like me are interested in group behaviors. We're interested in how groups have an impact on individuals and how groups can bring changes to society. One way we study this is by listening to people's life stories and analyzing to what extent these stories represent the groups individuals are part of. Sociological data of the type that I and other sociologists collect allows us to get past the loud, combative voices that often drive public debate and gain a more nuanced and accurate picture of what people think and value and believe. Sociology has different tools than other kinds of disciplines. It doesn't have the same tools as philosophy or theology. It can't really tell us the right way to live as people. But if we know how we want our communities or our churches or our laboratories to be different, then sociology can help us change group cultures and engage in practices that help us affect change. And when it comes to examining science and faith, sociology provides a key insight. Science and religion are not just sets of ideas or thought systems, although they are indeed these things. Science and religion are also communities of people, communities like laboratories and churches and universities and denominations. And some people, of course, are part of both of these communities. Here's another insight. Science and faith share core values and virtues that could bring these communities together to work for the common good. And I want to argue and really claim tonight that common good has never been more needed than it is right now. We are in the midst of a global push to address the pandemic medically and to heal its collateral damage that will require the best that religious and scientific communities have to offer, and that will require these communities working at top capacity together. Science is bringing us the medical knowledge that we need to address this pandemic, and religious organizations are going to need to be a key part of applying these medical insights as well as healing the collateral damage of the pandemic. I want to turn now to discussing four values out of the eight discussed in my book, values that I think lead us beyond fear to collaboration, values that I think are really important in these times. The first value is curiosity. I'm going to tell you another story. You realize I'm kind of a storyteller. I love to tell a story. You remember some conversations really for the rest of your life. I interviewed Jill, as I call her, this is a pseudonym, for my first study of how scientists view religion. It's quite a while ago now. She was already at the top of her field. She was a biologist leading a successful laboratory at an elite research university. She's one of the only women in her institution at her level and one of the less than 10% of women in her field of science at her level. As I walked toward her office, I noticed her door had a sign of the Darwin fish eating the Christian fish, the ichthus symbol. I was conducting at that point my first study on scientists' attitudes towards faith, and the sign actually made me nervous. As I knocked, I actually knocked a little tentatively, and I started to think maybe it would be okay if Jill had forgotten the appointment for her interview, actually. But she did come to the door right away. She didn't do anything to put me at ease. She didn't greet me with a handshake or a smile. She stood and just asked me to sit in the metal chair that was across from her desk. She told me she had nothing to say about science and faith. She was just participating in my study out of courtesy because she supported social scientific research. I remember kind of wondering if the air conditioning in the office was on full blast or if I just felt kind of cold. My first question to Jill was if she practiced a religion or considered herself a person of faith. No, she replied, I'm simply an atheist. I then asked her whether she'd been raised in a faith tradition. This was the type of question that you could have answered with yes or no. I was really taken aback when Jill looked away from me and her eyes began to fill with tears. In the years since then, I have interviewed nearly 1,000 scientists face to face about what they think about faith and religion. And still, Jill is the only one who has cried. As her tears welled up, my own feelings really changed and turned from a sense of apprehension to a sense of compassion. I also became curious about why the question about her faith background elicited such emotion. Jill told me that she came from a Christian family and as a child had spent a lot of time at church. She was raised in a rural community and she also spent a lot of time outdoors and she began to see the beauty in nature and to develop a real love of the natural world. She spent a lot of time in her schoolwork too. She loved her biology and her chemistry classes. She said she was a total geek and that she got fantabulous grades. But as she became more curious about the natural world, she also became concerned about aspects of her faith. She brought questions about the origin and development of life on earth and the role of God in creation to her parents and her pastors. At that point, Jill didn't know that she would go into science. She was simply an inquisitive kid. She was following and feeding her natural curiosity. But she said that when I asked hard questions of the faith, I was told by my pastors and my youth group leaders just to make a decision to believe, to forget about science, she said. That answer didn't satisfy Jill. She tried several times again with her youth group leaders to ask them hard questions that science had brought to mind, but her experiences with them were similar. She was consistently told not to explore so much. She said, "I feel like religion was a mechanism that was really used to pass judgment on people who are different." And she felt like I was so different because I was so inquisitive. And I didn't know that other people were inquisitive as well. And she said, and for me and my personal history and my childhood, it was a kind of judgment that didn't work out so well for me. And by the time she was in her teens, Jill had left her church community. Sometimes even now though, she's still curious about faith. What is it, she said, that keeps people from believing? I feel like when religion works, you get a real sense of community, she said. But when it doesn't work, she said, you get judgment that shuts down curiosity. How do we nurture curiosity in church communities and in scientific communities and as an antidote to fear? As a character trait, The philosopher Elias Baumgarten writes, curiosity is a disposition to want to know more, to learn about a variety of things. Curiosity is at the core of what motivates a lot of scientists to do their work. The more we have this character trait, the more often, the more intensely we want to explore. We have a desire to urge, to learn, to investigate. But in our current culture, the word curious can seem kind of small and weak. It brings to mind a child wandering around the corner and wondering before they take a look. Our culture seems to prefer stronger words like expert or leader or winner. But we need to value more highly in our society the ability to ask questions that help us better understand ourselves and others, that help us lead better lives. Let's ask different questions together. Let's get curious and let curiosity replace our anger and our fear of one another. Let's ask why. Curiosity, I think, is actually a show of strength, a yearning to push the boundaries of knowledge. Scientists like Jill are often known for the curiosity. For example, the string theorist, Sylvester James Gates Jr., who was the first Black American to have an endowed chair in physics at a major research university, and who's currently the president of the American Physical Society, sometimes speaks about the relationship between science and faith. And Gates says he got used to being curious, to asking hard questions at a really young age. And he said that his family and his dad in particular really nurtured that sense of curiosity. And I want to see us be concerned about this, those of us who have responsibility for raising children. He said to his dad, "Dad, do you remember me asking as a kid all kinds of questions?" And my dad said to me, "Yes, I do." And I said, "You always seem like you had an answer for everything, Dad." And Dad said, "I didn't actually. I just say, keep asking questions. What you don't remember, son, is if I didn't have an answer immediately, I would tell you to hold off and I would go and get a resource or I would read something and I would come back and answer your question. But I didn't want you to stop asking questions." Even though no one in Gates's family was a scientist, they had created an environment that nurtured a deep sense of curiosity in him. My research shows that Christians are often curious about the relationship between science and faith and how they can integrate science with their faith. This curiosity can be painful and stressful sometimes, but I think Christian communities can become safe places for the curious, especially those who are curious about science and faith. The most valuable resource in the Christian community is perhaps a relational resource. It's those who have the personal experience and accomplishment, the fellow Christians who have already successfully integrated science and faith, some of them who are even living a scientific life out of their faith. From these Christians, we can learn new ways of looking at the relationship between science and faith and have a sense of curiosity for science, actually, that's supported within our church communities. I want churches to become places that offer the kind of reward of nurturing and satisfying curiosity about science. Take a second pause, if you would, with me. Look at that list of fears you wrote down and ask yourself, how can you become curious about what is behind those fears? How can you become curious about what is behind those fears? And write that down. The second shared value I'm going to talk about tonight is humility. I've been humbled a lot, and I bet a lot of you have been really humbled in these last months as well. Here's one way I've been humbled through my research as a social scientist. If you'd asked me when I first started my research whether there are many ways of being a religious scientist, I, who was trained initially as a sociologist of religion, would have said there are tons of varieties of religious expression. Of course, there are many ways of being religious and being a scientist. But if you asked me if there were many ways of being an atheist scientist, I probably would have said at that point about 15 years ago, not really. Being an atheist is kind of modal. You just don't believe in God. Simple as that. I was super sure I was right. But as a sociologist, I've learned to doubt my assumptions, especially the assumptions I have about characteristics of groups. And my studies of scientists over the past 15 years have shown me that there are actually varieties of atheism among scientists. That's just one of the ways that my research has humbled and changed my previous thinking about a topic. I've actually gotten so interested in the varieties of atheism among scientists that my colleague David Johnson and I are actually writing a book on that topic. Humility is recognizing the limitations of our own understandings and abilities and perspectives. From a Christian standpoint, humility at its core is being very deeply aware that we are not God. Sometimes this happens the hard way. Another story from my own life. Sometimes you think you're going to conquer time, for example, and what you wind up with is a big purple toe that conquers you. Wait for it just a minute and you'll know what I mean. A few years ago, I can't believe I'm saying this out loud in front of dozens of people, but a few years ago, I had a foot problem in the form of an ingrown toenail. While embarrassing to say out loud, it does not sound like that big of a deal. But by the time I had admitted how much pain I was in, I was seated in my doctor's office. My toe was totally swollen. The podiatrist walked in, took one look at the toe and announced that it was completely infected and that I would actually need minor surgery. He told me that I was totally in luck because he could fit me right in that day. You need some background here to fully understand the story. So for a long time, I've actually been quite afraid of hospitals. I'm also afraid of needles and blood. But when a doctor tells you you're in trouble and that you have a serious problem and require even a minor surgery, you have humility. You listen. I have a PhD in one field, but I'm not a medical doctor, and I have a lot of humility about my medical knowledge. I don't have as much humility about my time limitations. After the minor surgery, the doctor told me this. He said, you know, just take the rest of the day off. Go home, put your foot up, watch some TV. I said, sure, I'll totally do that. What I didn't tell him was that I actually planned to go ahead with several hours of afternoon meetings. I thought I'll be sitting in those meetings. It's the same as putting your foot up, right? Kinda. One was the main university leader. I was not going to let a minor surgery stop me. I actually walked out the door with a slight limp because, remember, to have surgery, they had to numb up the foot. And I didn't actually even feel it when my foot banged right into the exit door. And I looked down to see that my beige bandage actually had turned completely red with blood. I turned around, I went back into the doctor's office to ask for help. Unfortunately though, the office had actually run out of beige bandages and all they had left was bright purple. This time the nurse wrapped it around my foot so many times, it was so large that it was a very clear reminder that I had to take care of it, take it slow, take time to rest. Sometimes there are signs of the need to practice humility about what we know, but also our capacities, our physical capacities, what we can do. Big purple signs, for example. Christians ought to be familiar with the theological idea of humility. As Christians, our faith reminds us in a very deep sense that God is God and we are not, that God is God and we are not. And that full truth can never be known because of our human limitations and our limited ability to know the mind of God. It's not that there is no truth, but as human beings, we don't yet see things clearly, as the pastor and theologian Eugene Peterson translates in the paraphrase of the Bible called The Message. We're squinting in a fog. We're peering through a mist. On this earth, we are all constrained by our limited human knowledge. Humility, especially intellectual humility, is a key scientific virtue. In a study of scientific virtues conducted by Robert Pennock, he found that humility to evidence defined as the willingness to abandon a preferred hypothesis when faced with conflicting results, was one of the 10 most widely held values of science as named by top scientists. My studies have examined how scientists practice humility in their pursuit of understanding and truth. A few years ago, I read an article by the scientist Amanda King, and in it, she described her experience when she was just starting out as a PhD student. And I think it shows us that what the practice of humility can look like in science if it's done well. She said she was about 2 hours into a meeting where she was talking with those seated around on the table about her research work when she stopped and she kind of had an awareness that she was only person in the room without at least one doctoral degree. I love those people who have more than one PhD. It's like, did you not have enough time on your hands? Good night. She writes, but so why were they treating me with such unearned respect? She goes on to credit humility. And she says, humility doesn't mean meekness. And humility does not mean unconditional deference. Humility doesn't mean not standing up for what you believe in, including when you believe in your own scientific findings. Humility means being open to the possibility of being wrong, being willing to consider other people's ideas, and being respectful of your seniors, your peers, your subordinates. From my own studies and experiences in science, I've seen that intellectual humility and relational humility embodying kindness and respect for the ideas of others, no matter their status, go hand in hand. When we recognize that we are limited in our own understandings and abilities and perspectives, we then become humble and kind about the limitations of others. And we have a deep sense that we can learn something from every person. I've also noticed that practicing relational humility is not always easy for scientists, myself included. Science can be an extremely competitive environment. It often seems to chew up and spit out individuals with little regard for human dignity, as one scientist told me. Scientists often work incredibly long hours with no guarantee of payoff in their scientific findings. And we often get so caught up in our careers that we forget the community of people that we are engaging with every day who deserve to be treated with respect because of their core humanity. We can also become too concerned with institutional prestige and status and winning awards. Yet I've also found that scientists often practice relational humility in the workplace. Many of the about 30% of university scientists I've interviewed who are Christians have told me that caring for those they work with and mentor is extremely important for them as a part of working out their Christian faith. They often view their coworkers and students as people who are created in the image of God and imbued with inherent value. One Christian biologist recounted how he tried to use humility to shift the organizational culture of his work environment. He wanted to make sure that there was a greater awareness that science is more than just a set of ideas and methods. It's more than a career for him. It's more than a method. He said it's also a community of people that Jesus loves. Another scientist explained how her moral commitments as a Christian influence how she treats others, regardless of their rank or background. She explained, as a Christian, I believe that people are equal and that everybody has the potential for good that makes them intrinsically valued. I want you to pause again and write down your answer to this question. How might you, in your own domain of influence, I think sometimes we don't recognize our own power, all those that we have influence over in our own circles. How might you, in your own domain of influence, practice true humility to address the divisions in our world that you see around you? How might you, in your own domain of influence, in your own relationships, practice true humility to address the relational divisions you see around you? The third shared value between science and faith that I want to touch on briefly is healing. You should hear what they say about you, my daughter, she's a talkative one, said at the dinner table one night. She was telling us that some kids had been actually picking on her about her parents. Do you want to know what they say about you, Daddy? My husband said he wasn't sure, but she persisted. They say, your dad has gray hair. Is he your grandfather? We talked about this for a bit. My husband took it really well. But then she turned to me and she says, "That you should hear what they say about you, Mama." "Well, what do they say?" I replied, trying to sound kind of nonchalant, while my heart was actually secretly racing at the thought of what might come next. They say, "Your mom's hands look really weird. Does she have something wrong with her?" Her words actually brought a little bit of emotion, and I started to tear up a little bit. Because you see, most days for the past 30 years, I've experienced at least some pain in my hands, a result of joint degeneration from rheumatoid arthritis. In high school, there were times when I sat on my hands so that others wouldn't notice that they were turning blue at the slightest bit of cold. When I got married, I wore long gloves because on that day, I didn't want to think about my hands. I've largely dealt with these emotions, and now I very rarely feel like I need to hide my hands. But thinking of other kids teasing my daughter because of my hands kind of brought it home at another level. My hands have caused physical and emotional suffering, though I know that my suffering, while significant to me, has been so small when compared with the suffering of so many others, a reality that I've been made so deeply aware of in these pandemic times. And medicine and doctors have also been able to alleviate a lot of my suffering. When my daughter was 3 and I just started leading a big international research study, my orthopedic surgeon told me that the cartilage in my hip joint had been completely worn away. Every step I took with my then 38-year-old body racked me with pain. He looked at me and he said, "You must be suffering. I think I can get you in for surgery next week." I asked him, "You know, how am I going to be able to take care of a 3-year-old while recovering from a hip replacement? And how will I continue leading my studies and doing my work?" And he looked right back at me and he said with a pretty soft voice for a top-level surgeon, "I think I can help you with this." 4 weeks later, I ambled slowly behind a walker, the kind you see used by 90-year-old ladies in nursing homes, and into my classroom to teach. 8 weeks later, I sent my doctor a picture of me hiking in the hills of California. I have deep, deep respect and gratitude for what I think many aptly call the wonders of modern medicine. Without them, rheumatoid patients like me would not be able to walk. My research shows that members of both the scientific community as well as Christian communities place high value on alleviating the suffering of others. They place high value on the virtue of healing. About 40% of Americans say that they are very interested in new medical discoveries, and that number is even higher among those who are Christians. Suffering is a great mystery, and human suffering is something that when it's in our power, we should do so to alleviate, one Christian professor of biology told me. He believes using his research to alleviate suffering is actually part of his calling as a scientist. Another biologist who's also a Christian said that he sees scientific research and technology as actually a gift from God to intervene and to provide relief from suffering. Research has shown that a lot of Christians appreciate medicine's ability to reduce physical suffering like mine. According to one national survey, Christians and non-Christians actually differ little in their affirmation of medicine. And a number of Christians I interviewed spoke positively about medical technologies as ways to alleviate suffering and offer healing to others. One Christian I interviewed said medicine is a gift from God, and medicine was given to the doctors and the researchers to help people. "For us," he said, "it's just praise the Lord that doctors have been given the knowledge to be able to come up with things like that," a youth minister told me about cancer treatment technologies that his wife was using. I too am so grateful, as I said, for science and medicine. I'm particularly grateful for a Dr. Subbarao, an Indian biochemist who developed a drug called methotrexate, which was originally meant to treat cancer, and that revolutionized how I felt during a flare-up of my disease in my early 20s, about 10 years after my diagnosis. I can relate to Subbarao's belief that science merely prolongs life, but religion deepens it. Words that were inscribed on a plaque near the entrance of an antibiotic manufacturing facility in Bombay dedicated in his honor. I'm grateful that God bought me Subbarao and the rheumatologist who thought to prescribe the medicine to me in my life. I'm also grateful for advances in science and medicine that have reduced suffering, brought healing, and generally improved the lives of others. I'm in agreement with the 85% of Christians I've surveyed who think that science and medicine bring good to the world. The fourth shared value is shalom. Shalom is a Hebrew word that comes from a root that means completeness and perfection. It is the peace, harmony, well-being, and prosperity that result from the flourishing of all creation. And I want to really acknowledge tonight that it is hard to appreciate shalom in these times. It's hard to realize it. It's always been hard to realize it. We're just more deeply aware of that right now. Back when I could actually go to my workplace on campus rather than working from home as I have for the past year, I wrote the following. I wrote, the pressures of being a researcher in the social science include things like applying for grants, teaching, mentoring, committee work, writing, administrative work, program management, alongside the rest of my life, my parenting, my work in my church, the ordinary inundations of modern living make it really, really hard for me to get to stillness. And here's one way that I try. After I drop my daughter off at school in the morning, I say a prayer. I say this. The first part of my prayer is the rendition of a phrase from the Hebrew Bible in the Christian Old Testament from a psalm that says, "Be still and know that I am God." I repeat that phrase, "Let me be still and know that you are God," as I walk from my house to the university campus. I walk quickly as I pray. Let me be still. Thoughts of what I need to get done in the work ahead and what I've left undone tend to inundate me. As I wait for the light in front of the campus to turn green, I stand on one foot and the other, trying to get a few balance exercises in that my physical therapist told me to every day to do. I'm super easily distracted. Let me be still. Once I'm on campus and through the beautiful entrance, I walk through a beautiful art installation, which has a square in the top that's open to the sky, and I stop there and look. Let me know that I'm fully loved by God. I pray this piece of the prayer because I often feel that there are so many people to impress as part of my work. There are colleagues and students and funders and reviewers, just to name a few. And the culture of academic science is pressure-filled and competitive and cutthroat, and I often feel too limited. Let me know that I am fully loved. The last part of my walk takes me up several flights of stairs to my office. And on each of those stairs, I try to say the phrase, "Let me enter into what you are already doing today." And I remind myself that I am participating in what God is already doing on my campus and in the world. In my interviews with scientists, I have found that many Christians feel similarly as I do about their work and their goals, sometimes drawing on the concepts of shalom and stewardship. Shalom, though, I want to be clear, cannot be pretended into being. In its best sense, it means to get involved in the messiness of the world, to muck it up with the structures that are not just, to make them more just. The theologian Walter Brueggemann writes in The Prophetic Imagination, "Jesus in his solidarity with the marginal ones is moved to compassion. Compassion constitutes a radical form of criticism, for it announces that the hurt is to be taken seriously, that the hurt is not to be accepted as normal and natural, but is actually abnormal, unnatural, an unacceptable condition for humanness. Thus, the compassion of Jesus is not to be understood just as a personal emotional reaction, but as a public criticism in which he dares to act upon his concern against the entire numbness of the social context. Some of the Christian Scientists I interviewed explicitly discussed increasing representation and equality in science as one of their goals and one of the ways they enter into shalom through their work as scientists. Some of these scientists specifically connect their faith to their efforts to increase opportunities for those who are underrepresented in science. And this is an area about which, as a sociologist, I am particularly passionate. When we look at the US scientific workforce, we see that non-whites, but especially Black and Hispanic Americans, are vastly underrepresented in science. For example, when we consider Black Americans, who comprise about 13 to 14% of the US population, these folks make up just over 1% of all those in careers in science, medicine, or technology. Women of all racial and ethnic groups are underrepresented in much of science and medicine. Women, of course, make up a little more than 50% of the US population, but represent far less than 10% of most scientific fields. And yet, Black Americans, Hispanic Americans, Asian Americans, and women are all overrepresented in our church communities and our Christian communities. Nearly 80% of Black Americans see themselves as committed Christians, for example. One reason Black and Hispanic Americans are underrepresented in science is that they are more likely to attend lower resource schools with poorer science education. A related problem is that Christians from underrepresented minority groups don't often hear about scientists who look like them or scientists who believe like them. One Christian geneticist I met and interviewed was one of the few Black women in her field in an elite research university. She was the first woman and the first Black American to become head of a large genetics program. During the 5 years she spent as a student, she said that there was only one Black speaker brought in for her department's weekly seminar. For a lot of African Americans, science is a no trespassing zone, one Black pastor I interviewed said. I do think it's helpful to have someone of your own color and your own faith be in science, a Hispanic pastor told me, because to see one of your own would give you such an inspiration. Representation matters, and the lack of representation of women and minorities in science is an issue that ought to concern churches who care about science and faith. Science needs more diversity. And Christians have a responsibility to be concerned about that lack of diversity and the injustices that cause it as a part of seeking shalom. Those who have been and are most marginalized in our society are often those who care most about fighting on behalf of the marginalized, fighting structures and engaging in efforts that demarginalize others. We need to show folks that the science career can be used to care for people in the interest of justice, equality, and human flourishing. Churches, I'd like to see more of you interested in ensuring that minority students have access to science resources and that minority voices are included in your dialogues about science and faith. If you look at the faith and science conversation in particular, it's mainly white people. A biologist in one of my studies who is a person of color said. In his view, we need to engage the entire church in the United States on faith and science issues. How we engage on faith and science really does include Black churches and Hispanic churches and Asian churches, and their experiences are different, and they might have different questions, and so we should ask them. And it's striking that sometimes there might be resistance to that. I want to end, because I know my time is coming to a close, I want to end with touching briefly on gratitude, another important value for these times, ironically, and a way of addressing the fears that people have of each other right now. Through my studies and my own personal experiences, I found that gratitude, A deep, true sense of gratitude is actually antithetical to fear and anger, emotions some Christians feel towards some scientific findings and scientists, and that some scientists feel towards religion and religious ideals. One pastor said to me, is that what's so unique in the African-American church that I work in is that it is a theology rooted in gratitude rather than suspicion, which is a very different posture for addressing life issues that come your way. And it separates how you would approach science, how you would approach theological tradition, how you would approach theological questions. If you have a deep sense that God is good and you know the reality of accepting that God is good, he said. You may not understand it, but you're being okay and you're questioning and you're recognizing that God is good. According to the writer Diana Butler Bass, who's written a book on gratitude, gratitude is not about stuff. Gratitude is the response to the surprise of our very existence, to sensing that inner light and realizing the astonishing, sacred, social, and scientific events that brought each one of us into being, that allows us to value each person, that allows us to cry out like the poets of the Christian tradition to say, I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
Thank you so much, just for your openness and your vulnerability.
Oh, thank you for saying that. I always feel like, I mean, I've like written this stuff on paper and in books, but it's still really different when you say it out loud. I really appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, and even weirder, I'm acutely aware. So I have kids as well. And my daughter was saying the other day, she's 10, and I want to be careful because I hope every parent thinks their kid is brilliant. She is our kid who we literally have to go, oh, how are we going to steward this? because she asks questions and always has that are way beyond my capability. But she said, you know, Mom, God created us, but is it possible that God also needed us to create things like Zoom? Because you couldn't even do your job at this point if Zoom didn't exist. And I thought... And she is deeply, deeply interested in science, and art is the honest answer. I listened to you when you said you walk through the beautiful arches at your school. And so do you have any kind of words of wisdom about how do we continue to encourage our young people down to our littlests, but all the way through to say, what if we became fascinated with science? And I also want to be careful because I've got some friends I know from school things and kid things, and it's parents who are like, oh, stay away from that. You know, if you love Jesus, you can't possibly do any of that. And our kids are all in the same classes together.
Yeah.
So I know that's not quite what you have studied, but because I know you have kids, and because this is a group of scientists and I want them to be respected by the upcoming generation. So do you have any thoughts on that as we are now? I'm seeing some questions coming in, but we'll start there and then we'll get to everybody else's.
Yeah, no, I was actually really excited that you are a leader in thinking through the theology of youth ministry, because I think that's incredibly important. And we need a lot of people. We need to get our best intellectual energy going into how we think about caring for our youth who are asking hard questions. And so one of the things that actually my research on scientists has shown me is that people tend to end up being scientists are super inquisitive as kids, right? Like you think about someone who ends up being a scientist at a research university, a place like Arizona State, a place like Princeton, a place like Rice University where I work. These are people who were bright to begin with, right? Often, and they had that stewarded well, usually. And so if they are in churches, we need to provide as parents and youth leaders and pastors a real context where it's okay to ask hard questions, to really bring your hardest questions to church. And I think sadly, and I get it. Cause my child asks me questions sometimes that I'm really afraid of, that when your kid asks you a question that you can't answer, there does, result in a kind of, it results in a kind of fear sometimes. And I get that. We don't have to go it alone though. There are lots of phenomenal resources, in American society, at least. I know there are folks in this session who are from different national contexts. We often feel like we have to parent in a silo. It's just like me and my kid. And there's a community of people out there. And there are some, if you don't know the answer, there's someone who does, who can speak into your child's life in a really positive way. And so to really help each other in that way, I think is super important.
No, I think that's great. My most humbling came after, when we were able to go to the pool, and my daughter watched them do the acid base test that they do at pools. And she's super excited at the changing of colors. And then she came home and she said, you know, Mom, all those diagrams, when you see the bodies, there's always blue and red for the blood. So is our blood acid and base as well? And I thought, huh, you're 8. And I'm literally already tapping out of being able to respond to you. So dear scientists who are listening, we need you. To be able to continue, because here we have, I often say that young people are natural theologians. I think they're natural scientists as well, because they're curious. And so we have to continue to foster that. And so I love this. I'm looking at the questions off to the side. So the first question really fits right in. It says, how can we help the body of Christ to embrace deep thinkers from a young age, to encourage them to ask why without fear? So can I jump in and offer a thought?
Yeah, please, please. Yeah.
My first thought on that, honestly, is we need to let youth pastors and church leaders be okay with saying, oh gosh, I don't know. I studied theology. I don't know, you know, astrophysics. I don't always know how to discuss quantum mechanics, but I think it's important. And so let's learn that together. Because I think what ends up happening, and it taps into your conversation about fear, instead, we feel stupid. You know, scientists, if you don't know this, y'all are smart. You're like freakishly smart. And so sometimes we feel stupid. Now, I'm fortunate that I'm old enough now where I realize scientists know what scientists know. And they're very brilliant in their own area, but they also have their own anxieties and insecurities outside of their fields. And so if we were able to approach that, we're back to your virtues, the conversation about humility and curiosity. But I think if we can invite both groups to be able to say, I don't know, but what an amazing thing if we could say, but I know a scientist who might be able to have a better conversation with this. Can you wait a week?
I think that's a great idea. And I also want to encourage churches to join together. There are those of us who study churches know that sometimes they're pretty demographically similar, sadly. And so would there be space for churches to help each other out, the churches that have scientists connect with churches that don't? I think there's some real interesting synergies that could take place here.
That's good. The next question, it says, Elaine, it is a truism that science cannot move from an is to an ought. Science can tell us how to build a nuclear weapon, edit a genome, or safely abort a fetus, but it cannot tell us whether what conditions these actions are right or wrong. In your experience, are atheist scientists willing to admit this fact? And if so, what resources, I think it's supposed to say, do they rely on to make such judgments?
Yeah, that's a really relevant question. We're facing a lot right now in our society with the pandemic, but also beyond, where we have rapidly developing technology. And scientific technology develops much more rapidly than the ethical reflection about it does. And That is a truism. Ethical reflection is extremely slow and needs to be more considered. And many scientists, both those who are persons of faith and those who are not, are very concerned about this, that there is not the kind of space that science needs to reflect ethically on how science ought to be used in society. We've seen this recently with human reproductive genetic technologies of the sort that change generations, that actually change the gametes of people so that you are changing something for generations of a person. And so, you know, that is illegal in most national contexts. And we've had a lot of ethical discussion about that. And many in the scientific community will say, you know, we need space to think through how to apply these technologies. And so there's just, that's a very, very good question. And, you know, keep going in your own thinking about that question, because it's really the question of the day.
That's great. Thank you. I can think through every once in a while. I teach at a Christian university. And so there's that obligatory worldview Christian-y class that everybody has to take, whether they're Christians or not. And I'll have students who will say, well, but I'm moral because I'm human. Mm-hmm. And then we get to unpack this great conversation of what does it mean to be human? Mm-hmm. And how do we understand that? And why do you think being human qualifies you to make those kinds of choices around science and space and technology and cell phones and a whole host of things? And so it always turns into this really great, robust conversation. Your next question, it says, can you repeat the question you asked us around using our influence? I wrote it down if you want me to jog your memory. I'm sure you are brilliant and your notes are right there. But
I know they are, but I'm having, that was about 20 pages ago.
I am
just joking.
Let me help you, because I'm sure that you would say, this is exactly what you said. So let me just quote you. You put, how might you, in your own domain of influence, practice true humility to address the relational divisions around you?
Yes, that was what I said. Thank you. That could have possibly been worded more simply, but I didn't. There's a lot of pain and difficulty going on in our world. I know from recent national survey data that we are incredibly polarized right now. And I can feel extremely overwhelmed by that. There are just no end of things I can do. And so, or I ought to do. And I also have very low energy. And I'm a person who has a lot of resources. So I can only imagine the kind of pain and stress that folks are under who have even more demanding lives than I do. And so I've been trying to think lately, just what can I do in my own sphere of influence? So how can I be humble in my interacting with others? And I don't mean, you know, we don't say what we think or we're doormats. What I mean is we have a posture of knowing that we don't know everything and that we can learn from any other human person. That there's some, just by, I believe as a Christian, that just by virtue of the fact that a person is walking around on this earth or living and breathing on this earth, that there is some goodness there, that there is some positive goodness that we can learn from. And so if we sort of started with that posture, just with the people who are in our own circle, you don't have to go out and get new people. I think there's a lot to be done towards if we can adopt that kind of posture.
I had a really unusual, you know, things that you can't set up kind of experiences this week. I took my father to the oncologist. He's at stage 4 from Agent Orange.
Oh, God.
We're steeped in all kinds of things, but we were at the oncologist today. And I've gotten to know this brilliant oncologist over the last several years. And in the appointment for my dad, I told him about this conference. And he said, oh, that sounds fascinating. He said, you know, I have a colleague who's one of my closest friends. And he said, we line up on all of our kind of philosophical approaches to treatment and management and what that looks like. And he said, but my friend thinks I'm a coward. I said, what does that mean? And he said, well, he thinks I'm a coward because I believe in God. And he said, you're a theologian who comes in here. And I go in and I'm like, listen, I got nothing. I don't understand all of the details of cancer and what's happening. I can talk the talk at this point. I'm really good at a lot of the conversation. So I sound like I know what I'm talking about, but it's really parroting and advocating. And so he knows that I admire him greatly, but he said, you think I have a lot of answers. And he said, but I'm curious, do you think I'm a coward because I believe in God? And I thought, what an interesting display of humility from, he is the senior oncologist in a major practice here in the Valley. And he's asking one of his patient's daughters what this is. And I thought that was such an interesting interchange as he is very much a scientist. And he said, you know, I don't talk about God with most people. And he said, I just happen to know what you do for a living. And there, wow, there became this really, really cool conversation that took place.
Yeah, I do think that for some of us, these times are really, I don't know exactly how to put it in the right way, Amy. I like stripping away pretense. Yeah, there's something that it's just not worth it to fake it anymore. You know, you just, it's like, if ever we were going to be real, now is the time. And so that is, I think a lot of people I know are really feeling that way.
Well, so that leads us to our next question that was sent in. It says, could you expand a bit on the virtue of humility from both sides of the issue? In the Eastern Orthodox Church, we speak of the apophatic theology to describe that which is veiled in mystery, beyond which we cannot speak authoritatively. Thank you, is what they wrote.
Oh, that's really neat. That's really neat. I wouldn't want us to go away from our discussion of humility thinking that there's nothing we should fight for, that there is no truth. I mean, I think there's a way in which we can misunderstand humility. I don't see humility as shutting down curiosity. That's why I sort of think about those two things together often. There's the kind of a sense that there's always something that's greater than we are, and that's, I think, just so important to know during these times, in which can counteract things like hubris and anger right now, that if we just have a sort of deep sense that there's something greater than ourselves and that we don't know everything, that there's always, and that's the kind of excitement in that, there's always more to know and always more to learn. There's always more creative exploration.
I would say also that apophatic theology, it invites us into a space of curiosity. That idea of mystery, that there are some things we either just do not yet know, or perhaps never will know, but man, I'm going to spend my life trying. And so, yeah, that's a beautiful connection, I think, between faith and science, is that there's still mystery. The next question is, how can Christian scientists and educators foster the development of these virtues in the next generation of scientists and leaders, particularly for Christian educators in secular institutions?
It's hard. And I talk a lot. I couldn't really spell it out here in the confines of the length of the talk, but I talk a lot in the broader book about the importance of practicing virtues and values in community. I do not think these are things that can you can go it alone with, that there is just a deep need to have communities infused with virtue, and to have things like humility and curiosity become habits. And practices and habits are best in committed communities. And so I think that's where it's really helpful to see, you know, science is not just a set of ideas, but it's a community of people, right? That have certain kinds of predispositions. And there are ways in which the faith communities and scientific communities can really help one another. And I don't think we start with that posture usually. We usually think like, how are these communities in tension? Instead of imagining how could these communities be helpful to each other through a sense of shared virtue. I think that's really important.
I'm going to riff off of that, but because I know you're a keen sociologist, you'll be able to do this. In my field, we talk often of the theological imagination. Mm. Now, the same conversation takes place, certainly, and I teach sociology classes as well, so I end up kind of double dipping. And I think I was even surprised as I started in sociology and did theology later in graduate school and PhD work, but I was like, oh, we all use the word imagination. Isn't that interesting? But I wonder how we could invite those virtues into our different disciplines. And so forgive me for those of you who are in disciplines I do not know, but I would imagine that there has to be a bit of imagination in almost every field. And so I wonder if there's a way to tie the virtues in to that imaginative element of our disparate fields. What do you think?
I do. So there's, you know, virtues are just like these empty words, unless they're embodied, unless they're practiced. And so, you know, I start thinking about, like, you know, how can we subvert dominant power structures and get involved in the messiness of the world such that we're in a Christian sense or a Jewish sense, imagining shalom or seeking the peace and goodness for the world. That's a lofty ideal, right? So what does that really mean in everyday academic life? Well, in my own field of sociology, even though we study inequality, we still practice inequality. So for example, if you go to an academic conference, people are actually looking at your name tag to figure out if you're from an institution where it's worth talking to you, right? If you're from a powerful institution or a less powerful institution. So one thing I've talked to my students some about is let's practice being circle wideners. So, you know, when people are standing in a conversation circle at an event and, you know, someone is kind of comes up from the back and people are like, no, I don't really want to talk to that person. Let's kind of close in. So instead, what if we take a step back and let the people in who are coming from the outside? So what if we're circle wideners? Well, that's a kind of easy, small way to begin subverting power structures of inequality, right? That's a small practice. And so, you know, could we imagine practices that might work in different kinds of settings? So that's what we might do in our communities is say, like, we want our community to embody this virtue of humility. And so what would be ways in which we might practice that together? So let's imagine together practices that would allow us to embody that virtue.
I think that's great. I also, you know, and I really sincerely meant it when I said, I think you were the perfect person to set the tone for this conference. I think there's that, perhaps taking those virtues and so addressing that question, how do Christian scientists and educators foster this development? What if, regardless of what your topic was, if you started out with those virtues? And, you know, we live in a weird world, because sometimes some people, I'm assuming, are on here who have a more relegated curriculum and others have more freedom. But if you get to be teaching students, whether it's in the classroom or virtually, we still get to foster those conversations. And what if there was that element of choosing each of these virtues and either covering them at the beginning and saying, these are going to be the ones through which we do our course, or weaving them in throughout the semester or the quarter?
That's really neat. That's really neat. Thank you.
Okay. So the next one, it says, do you have practical advice for navigating the divisive issues around the pandemic, especially with regards to masking and vaccinating?
Yeah, I mean, I really do think that the best medical science says that masking works. And so, you know, but then how do you treat people who differ there, right? Or people who just you radically think are wrong. You know, there, I think a Christian virtue is what does it mean to treat people humanely and to treat people well as if they're made in the image of God, even if you radically disagree with them. And I think that's a really high order. And it's hard to just gut that one out, right? Because everything in our bodies, I mean, we've been trapped in our houses, or we've had to go to work and feel like we're in danger. I mean, we're all living on edge, and the people that are the most vulnerable in our society have been hurt the most by the pandemic. The deaths of Black and Brown people during these pandemic times are so much greater than the deaths of white people. And so there's a way in which you can start to feel angry for people towards people. And so then to just take a breath and to think, what does it mean to treat everyone with a sense of valuing their core humanity? And that's really hard. I hope I'm not coming off as Pollyanna-ish in any way. I'm not saying that we can't disagree with people, that we can't try to get people to change. But then what does it mean to do that where we have a core sense of valuing the humanity of everyone? And that's where real creative living needs to happen. And I really love that we're talking, you know, Amy, back and forth about this idea of having a sense of imagination, because it does take imaginative thinking to accomplish that. It's very easy to have a knee-jerk reaction. That's what all of our guts want to do right now because it's been so hard.
Because you're in Texas, have you seen any of the Facebook things by Friendly Neighbor Epidemiologist?
I don't think I have. Maybe okay. I don't know what you're talking about.
So I have not asked, and so I'm going to just, I will ask forgiveness instead of permission. One of my former students, who is now a pastor, his wife is a PhD in epidemiology.
Oh, great.
And so she's straight up an epidemiologist. And when all of this came about, people started asking her questions. So she now has a Facebook page named Friendly Neighbor Epidemiologist.
And I love that.
It has essentially become her full-time job. We keep laughing. We're like, are you still able to do your job? And she is. She's a mom, she's a pastor's wife, and she's an epidemiologist. But she goes through and she breaks down the science. And because this is a conference on faith and science, what she does is and she's the nicest person. Like, I think I'd be like, what's your problem? Do it right. She, however, is like, let me talk to you about what's actually happening and let's discuss your fears and your concerns. She's amazing. But she talks about kind of that interplay. And so for any of you who are interested, you don't have to agree with her, but she has at least already done the hard work of researching. And you can tell she's a true academic because she cites every post she has on Facebook.
I love that.
It's almost more like it's like a mini research paper all the time. And I'm like, you know, normal people just say stuff.
Yeah, normally people just say stuff. They don't add citations on Facebook, but more power to her. I love that. I'm going to start doing citations on Facebook.
Yeah, she has unending citations. It's but at the end of this, we're like, you really need, I don't know that it'll be needed 5 years from now, but like you've just written another dissertation. So, okay.
I think can I say something quickly? I think even if you disagree with someone, it's really worth knowing what's behind their fear. I think about, you know, we have in the U.S. had the Tuskegee syphilis trials where, you know, Black men were allowed to be infected with syphilis and experimented on at the hands of the government. And so there is within communities a founded sense of distrust of some forms of medicine and medical technology. And that's a different kind of fear and it's a founded fear. And so, it's something that's based in reality and based in truth. And so it's extremely important to know you know, what kind of fears people have and why they have those fears. And I just think that's incredibly important. And it just a really important piece of moving forward in the science and faith dialogue and just in relationships between scientific and medical communities.
Yeah. So your next question, it says, in your opinion, how did the church that birthed inquiries on the natural world end up apparently in a place where there is some apprehension with the church about science?
Yeah, there's a lot of books that have been written about that. there's a great book actually by a colleague of mine, Ronald Numbers at University of Wisconsin, who's an emeritus professor there now, called The Creationists, which really takes you through the history of the relationship between faith and science, at least as it has to do with accounts of creation. And so it is true that, you know, most people don't really have a sense of the history of science where Christianity and as well as Islam and other religious traditions were very much a part of birthing science, where people really saw themselves doing science and, as some have said, you know, thinking God's thoughts after him. So I think there is a really neat thing in knowing the history of just the importance of Christian thinking and Christian faith in the historical advancement of science. And so it's not something we talk about enough, but there's some great folks out there doing work in that area.
That's great. Thank you. So we have two more questions that are already listed here. I want to be mindful of time. I know for some of you, it must be really late. But so let me get to the next one. It says, we talked about fear among Christians concerning science and scientists. But in your experience, is there also a comparable amount of fear in the scientific community about faith? And if so, how can we deal with that fear in our conversations?
Oh, yes, there definitely is. I've written some about that through the book, The Why Science and Faith Need Each Other, is really a book that I've meant to be as accessible. You'll have to decide whether you think it actually is, but I've written it to be accessible to everyday Christians to use like in an adult education class or something. So it's very short and has discussion questions. But I've written a book I've written two books about the scientific community. So one called Science Versus Religion, What Scientists Really Think, and one about scientists' attitudes towards religion in 8 national contexts, which is called Secularity and Science, What Scientists Around the World Really Think About Religion. And in both of those books, our team collected a lot of data, and there is a lot of fear that some in the scientific community have of religious people broadly, not just Christians. And fear about how Christian mistrust of scientists will affect funding for scientific research in the US. That is a huge fear. Fear that certain kinds of Christian churches keep kids from being interested in science. These fears are somewhat founded. And so to just recognize that when some types of scientists say things about Christian churches or belittle or marginalize, which I don't encourage, I really actively argue against that, but there is sometimes some very bad experiences that these scientists have had in their own youth and their own background with Christian churches. And there is some well-founded fear of the way in which mistrust of scientists is having an impact on scientific work.
I think this final question, quite frankly, might be my favorite, but it's because my heart is always with adolescents. And so it says, do you have any practical advice for college students to help promote the idea of harmony between science and faith, where there is a culture at universities of the two being opposites? Is it about Christian science students having to be more outspoken about their faith, or does there just need to be more dialogue in general?
Oh, that's a great question. I agree with you, Amy. That's a really terrific question. So I would love, if I could have my way, you know, more what I call kind of boundary pioneers. So those scientists who really cross what the I think is an artificial boundary between science and faith, where they're part of Christian faith communities, but they're also active scientists. And I would like that to be a diverse set of people. I would like there to be scientists who are Christians, who are from different genders, different racial locations, different social class backgrounds, different national contexts, so that college students could see very openly through its lived practice that these things do not have to be in conflict. And they would have lots of different models for working that out. So I would love to see that happen. And I think there's efforts afoot to work in that direction, some encouraging efforts, but it needs to be much, much more. And there also needs to be a real emphasis on diversity of voices. I think we could do a lot.
If you like this and you want to hear more, like, share, review, and subscribe to this podcast. And from all of us here at the Veritas Forum, thank you.